Though written in the 1800s, Gustave Flaubert's novel, Madame Bovary, has a powerful message even for us today. The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome back to the program. You know, in college, I was an English major, creative writing. And my dream, even from as a youth and a young man, was to write novels. I didn't really care what I said in the novels. That is, I was cynical enough to know that at the age of 20 or 21, nothing I was going to say hadn't been said before. My goal was simply to say it more beautifully than anyone else had done before me. Or at least tried to, anyway. I had great fun at it. I loved language. I loved words. And for me, the story I was writing was really nothing but a vehicle to create something beautiful with words. All I wanted to do was create art, to use my imagination and the power of words, those mysterious little markings on pages that, in whatever language they come, can release inside us such emotion, such grand thoughts and ideas that have changed the world along with them. You know, it's really, language is amazing if you think about it. And to think about the role that words and language play in our lives. I don't think we'd be human without language. And certainly our existence, regardless of our physical form, would be radically different than it is if we didn't have language and if language didn't do for us what it does. In fact, I'm not even sure we could survive without language and what it does for us. Anyway, as I said, as a young man, in my early teens and early 20s, my life centered around writing fiction. And like any serious writer, I did an incredible amount of reading. You know, and because I wanted to be a novel writer, I read an incredible amount of novels. I basically tell anyone who's serious about being a writer, if you want to be a writer, you need to be a reader. I think it was the novelist James Joyce who once said something to the effect that he primarily considered himself a reader even more than a writer, or something like that. And, you know, I understand his point perfectly. The point is, any writer that's going to be worth anything at all is a reader as well. And thus, I read a lot of novels when I was young. Now, among the so-called sacred canon for fiction writers was the novel Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert. This was, for any serious writer, I think, a must read. I think, Flaubert achieved what I think every fiction writer would strive for, a powerful and beautiful book, fully rich of language, depth, and, not to be forgotten, great success in terms of being well-known. It's a classic. And when I read it again earlier this year, after having read it more than 30 years ago, I understood why it has received the acclaim it does. Written in French in the mid-1800s, it is considered to this day, and with good reason, one of the greatest novels ever written. Plus, as you can imagine, it has been subjected to an endless number of critiques and interpretations and on and on and on. I can't imagine how many doctoral dissertations have been on the book, looking at it from the standpoint of language, of structure, of philosophy, psychology, poetics, and on and on and on. And indeed, it is a rich book, probably filled with more layers than you can imagine on a single read. I would guess, too, that people probably read a whole lot more into it than Flaubert himself might have thought when he wrote it. And I guess he would have liked that, too. You know, I once wrote a play called Shadow Men, and I was thrilled about the fact that when people read it, they put ideas and things. They said they read this into it and they read that into it, themes and ideas that when I wrote the book, I didn't even think about. After they said what they did, I looked at it and thought, yeah, I could see that there. I guess that's part of this mysterious thing in human beings called the creative process. Of course, that's a topic that could take up plenty of other programs as well. Anyway, I want to spend some time on the book and look at it from a specific perspective, not a particularly unique perspective. In fact, on the contrary, in many ways, it's probably the most basic, broad, and obvious theme of the book. It deals with a young married couple, Charles and Emma Bovary. Charles is a doctor, a country doctor, whose first wife died, and then he married the daughter of a nearby patient. They eventually have a daughter themselves. The novel, pretty much plot-wise, tells the story of the small family, or more specifically, the destruction of the small family. The problem from the start is that Emma Bovary wasn't happy in the marriage or in her life in general, really. She is portrayed as, well, a very shallow, empty, self-serving person. Let me just read you a few excerpts from the story. Here's the beginning of it, early on. Before marriage, she thought herself in love. But the happiness that it should have followed this love not having come, she thought, have been mistaken. And Emma tried to find out what was exactly meant in life by the words felicity, passion, rapture, that seemed to her so beautiful in books. Notice, she had certain ideas about what life would be that she read about in books. And these ideas, felicity, passion, rapture, were what she longed for, and yet she wasn't finding in her marriage. She had certain emotional and sensual expectations that derived from books, you know, felicity, rapture, passion, whatever, and derived from books, and they weren't being met in her life. You know, surprise of surprises, huh? Anyway, more from the book. Accustomed to calm aspects of life, she turned, on the contrary, to those of excitement. She loved the sea only for the sake of storms and the green fields only when broken up by ruins. She wanted to get some personal profit out of things, and she rejected as useless all that did not contribute to the immediate desires of her heart. Wow, if something didn't contribute to the immediate desires of her heart, she rejected it. Whew. I mean, folks, talk about setting yourself up for disaster. Anyway, here is how Flaubert described her marriage. But the uneasiness of her new position, or perhaps the disturbance caused by the presence of this man, we're talking about her husband here, had sufficed to make her believe that she at last felt that wondrous passion, which till then, like a great bird with rose-colored wings, hung in splendor over the skies. And now she could not think that the calm in which she lived was the happiness she had dreamed of. In short, very simple, she wasn't happy in the marriage. She had visions of something better, something grander than what she had in her life. And worse is her husband in the book, Charles Bovary. Well, he's really portrayed as, well, kind of a bore. Kind of a Boris kind of a guy. I mean, there's no question he loved her, but he was all the way through the book seen as kind of a mediocre kind of a guy, you know. And early in the marriage, she's saying something like, oh God, why did I marry him? And she wondered about whom her friends had married and how much better their lives must have been than hers. This is what he writes about her. She's thinking about her friends. What were they doing now? In town, with the noise of the streets, the buzz of the theater and the lights of the ballroom. They were living lives where the heart expands, the senses burgeon out. But she, her life was as cold as a garret. His life was cold as a garret where dormer widows look on north. And ennui, the silent spider, was weaving its web in the darkness in every corner of her heart. Eventually, Emma Bovary began to live in a dream world. And the book is filled with line after line about the kind of fantasy she envisioned, some kind of wonderful existence filled with love and passion and desire, all fulfilled in a marvelous way, in a way that she herself had no part in during the life she now lived. Listen to this. She bought a plan of Paris, and with the tip of her finger on a map, she walked around the capital. She went up and down the boulevards, shopping at every turn, between the lines of the streets, in front of the white squares that represented the houses. At last, she would close the lids of her weary eyes and see in the darkness the gas jets flaring in the wind and the steps of the carriages lowered with much noise before the peristyles of theaters. He goes on, says the following. Listen to this. All her immediate surroundings, the wearisome country, the middle-class imbeciles, the mediocrity of their existence, it seemed to her exceptional, a peculiar chance that called hold of her, while beyond, as far as the eye could see, an immense land of joys and passions. She confused in her desires the sensuality of luxury with the delights of the heart, elegance of manners with a delicacy of sentiment. Did not love, like Indian plants, need a special soil, a particular temperature, signs by moonlight, long embraces, tears flowing over yielded hands, all the fevers of the flesh and languors of tenderness could not be separated from the balconies of great castles full of indolence, from boudoirs with silken curtains and thick carpets, well-filled flower stands, a bed raised on a dais, nor from the flashing of precious stones and the shoulder knot of liveries. An immense land of joy and passions. That's what this poor, deceived woman believed was just outside of town. An immense land of joys and passions that stretched, she said, as far as her eyes could see. I mean, talk about being set up to utterly, utterly fail. And what happens in the story? Well, it's pretty much what to be expected. Emma gets herself involved in an affair. Two, actually, and neither one, as affairs are apt to end up, gives her the joy and happiness and passion and love and all the things that she longed for. Sure, at first they were great, but it didn't last. In fact, she gets utterly crushed, especially by the second one, in which the man, a real cad, purposely seduces her, then makes all these great promises about taking her away and they'll live a life of travel, a life of passion and romance and love, all the things that she had been dreaming about. But the sad thing is he never had any intention of going away with her. She was beautiful, he seduced her, had his fun, enjoyed her physically, and then decided it was time to boogie and to split. In fact, rather than tell her face to face, he sends her a letter in a basket of apricots in which he writes to her what he knows are bald-faced lies. This is what he says. I shall never forget you. Oh, believe it. I shall ever have a profound devotion for you. But someday, sooner or later, this ardor, such as the fate of human things, would have grown less, no doubt. The world is cruel, Emma. Wherever we might have gone, it would have persecuted us. You would have had to put up with indiscreet questions, calumny, contempt, insult perhaps, insult to you. And oh, I, who would place you on a throne, who bear with me your memory as a talisman, for I am going to punish myself by exile for all the ill that I have done to you. I am going away, where I do not know. I am mad, adieu. Be good always. Preserve the memory of the unfortunate one who has lost you. Teach my name to your child. Let her repeat it in her prayers. Come on. But anyway, Emma, as a result, she has a mental breakdown and contemplates suicide. She recovers, seems to be doing better, but then gets into another affair, this time with a younger man, a torrid sensual affair that burns with passion for a while and then fizzles out, leaving her worse off emotionally than before. But even worse, she ended up spending all sorts of money on this affair, spending lavishly, all in hopes of achieving the life that she constantly fantasized about, a life that never came. On the contrary, by the time the second affair ended, not only was poor Emma Bovary emotionally and physically a wreck, but she brought upon her husband, Charles, who remained clueless. You know, he was an insensitive bore, I said, who thought his wife was having piano lessons when she was having this affair. She was holed up in a hotel with her lover. She brought upon him absolute financial ruins. Yeah, her affairs spent them all into bankruptcy. In the end, Emma, devastated, drinks arsenic and dies a painfully cruel death. Charles goes deep into mourning and never really comes out of it. Added to that, the financial ruin she brought on him, it got so bad that he had to start selling his own possessions in order to try to get out of the debt that she had brought upon him. Then too, not long after she dies, he discovers some of the letters, you know, her letters and that she had written to her lovers. And at one point he met one, the cat who promised to take her away but didn't. And Charles is so pathetically forgiving. You know, at one point he says to the man, a guy named Rudolph, that he doesn't blame him, but that, quote, fate is to blame. Fate? He chalks up this man sleeping with his wife to fate? What a total jerk. Well, what comes next? Listen to what Flaubert wrote. Randolph, who had controlled this particular fate, thought the man rather soft-hearted for someone in his position, comical and even despicable. Huh, no wonder. And anyway, here's how Madame Bovary ends. The next day, Charles went to sit down on the seat in the arbor. Rays of light were straying through the trellis. The vine leaves threw their shadows on the sand in the arbor. And the heavens were blue, the jasmines perfumed the air, Spanish flies buzzed around like the lilies in bloom, and Charles was suffocating like a youth beneath the vague love influence that filled his aching heart. At 7 o'clock, little Bertha, that's their daughter, who had not seen him all afternoon, went to fetch him for dinner. His head was thrown back against the wall, his eyes closed, his mouth open, and in his hand was a long tress of black hair. I think that was some of Emma's hair that he had cut. "Come along, Papa," she said, and thinking he wanted to play, she pushed him gently. He fell to the ground. He was dead. 36 hours after, at the druggist's request, Monsieur Canavet came thither. He made a post-mortem and found nothing. Isn't that interesting? Found nothing. When everything had been sold, 12 francs, 75 centimes remained that served to pay for Mademoiselle Bovary, that's the daughter, going to her grandmother. The good woman died the same year, and it was an aunt who took charge of her. She is poor and sends her to a cotton factory to earn a living. So the little girl, the father dies, the mother's dead, and the little girl is sent off to a cotton factory. Not exactly, and they lived ever happily after ending, is it? But then again, how often does it happen like that in real life anyway? You know, folks, why do I talk about this story? Why would I spend this time on this? But you know, if we're honest, we all have to admit that there's something inherently unsatisfying about life, isn't there? I mean, you know, we can all have good moments, and we might live in many ways what seems like a rich and fulfilling life, and that's fine. But still, isn't there always something a little wrong, something a little dysfunctional, something a little bit out of kilter and not quite right, no matter how great things are. And of course, that's when things are going great. But how often do they? You know, I don't know, but I look around at people, decent people, well-meaning people, some even church-going people. And you know, I see broken people. I see hurting people. I see sad and disappointed people. People living with what Thoreau once called lives of quiet desperation. Now, come on, I don't think I'm being that pessimistic here, am I? You know, they all, oh, what a negative view. No, I don't think I'm being pessimistic. I think I'm being realistic. There's something terribly, terribly wrong with us. There's something terribly broken about how humans, at the deepest level possible, there's something broken there. And I don't think anything ultimately in this life is going to totally change that. Some people, sure, overcome obstacles. People can and do rise above terribly debilitating trauma, either mental, physical, or both. And that's fine, and that's admirable. But even then, at the core, we're all still broken. We're all still damaged. We're all brought into this world not of our own choice and faced with a whole host of factors that are not of our own choosing either. I mean, we didn't choose when we were born. We didn't choose where we were born. We didn't choose our parents. We don't choose the political, financial, or cultural milieu in which we first entered the world, do we? You know, we were all handed a stacked deck even before we sat down to play. Now, this doesn't mean I believe in, as stupid Charles did, fate in the sense that our ends are predetermined regardless of the choices we make. Ugh, that's a horrible philosophy. You know, I know that there's a fair amount of reason to believe that, but I don't think the reasons are good enough to accept it are better than the reasons good enough not to accept it. Instead, I mean that right out of the gate, we often have a lot of factors working against us. And then sure enough, we're bound as humans to do, to make stupid choices along the way that make our lot simply even more pathetic than they would have been otherwise. I mean, who here hasn't made stupid choices that you sure wished you hadn't done that has only made your life that much more harder? Poor Emma Bovary had dreams about a world that existed only in her mind. And when she tried to make that fantasy world real, it only made her real world worse, the world real worse for her and for her family. Why, though, are humans so often unhappy? Why is life so hard? Why, no matter what we get, it just never seems enough? And no matter what happens, something is always lacking, something is missing, something just isn't right. Folks, I really think it's very simple. I've said this on other programs. We're fallen beings living in a fallen world. Our world was never meant to be like this. Sickness, death, suffering, despair, angst, loss. These are intruders, aliens that have never shouldn't have been here to start with. Now, I realize that this is a faith statement. A statement that, based on my understanding of revealed truth, truth that I've derived from the Bible, truth that I don't think I could ever get anywhere else. I mean, sure, nature hints at times of something wonderful, something beautiful, and I've talked about that, at something beyond what this world offers, but it doesn't explicitly spell it out. The point is, if this world is all that there is, then it's a pretty raw deal, isn't it? I mean, who among us hasn't imagined or still does imagine their own kind of dream world, their own fantasy world that, like Emma Bovary, stands in stark contrast to reality? It's like there's a world of fantasy that we hide into to escape the world outside. And yet, you could argue, as some would, that the world outside is known to us only by once inside, only by how our mind processes it. Thus, the world outside, the real world, and the fantasy world inside, they're in closer connection than we might think. That's fine, but it's crucial how important that we keep them apart. which is what Emma Bovary wasn't able to do. She wanted to make her fantasy world real, and all she ended up doing was making her real world worse than ever before. You know, we long for something. We all long for something that this world cannot offer. It's just true, and I think we all have to admit it. We're not sure what it is, because even when we get all that this world offers, it's still not enough. And that's because, again, this world as it is wasn't the way it was supposed to be. Wasn't the way. And that's why we have hope for something beyond this world, a hope for something better than what this world offers. Makes me think of a text, two texts actually, from the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, Revelation 21, 4 and 5. Listen to this. Listen to this promise. You want to fantasize about something? You want to fantasize about something that's not in your life now? Fantasize about this, because this is something that one day will be real. And God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Then he who sat on the throne said, "Behold, I make all things new." Wow, think about that. All things new. I mean, can you imagine a whole new world, a whole new life, a whole new existence? Can we believe that? Well, if you believe the Bible, if you believe the Bible, then you can believe that. And we've got very good reasons for believing the Bible. Is it true? Well, I believe it's true. If it's not true, and this life is all that there is, then you know something? We have nothing to hope in. We are stuck. If it's not true, we have nothing more to hope in than Emma Bovary's dreams, the empty dreams of a fictional woman who never existed. If that doesn't sound like much, you're right, it's not. Yes, Emma Bovary, though Flaubert wrote that book over 100-some years ago, one of the reasons I think it's so well-known and so famous is not just the beauty of the writing, not just the beauty of the story, not just how well it was done, but I think it was Flaubert himself once said, "Madame Bovary, c'est moi." He said, "Madame Bovary, that's me." And I think to some degree, it's not just him, Madame Bovary, c'est tout le monde. That's all the world, all of us.